I'm Mike Barnes, reading my paper, Who Do You Speak For and How? Online Abuse as Collective Subordinating Speech Acts, published in the Journal of Ethics and Social Philosophy in August of 2023. For this recording, footnotes have been omitted. This paper is about online abuse. I have two goals in directing our attention here. First, I want to show that this is a serious but neglected area of subordinating speech, and that social philosophers of language have good reason to pay more attention to the specific harms of online discourse. Second, I will argue that accounting for the realities of online abuse shows that speaker authority, the thing that makes harmful speech harm in the way it does, is dynamic and emergent and often depends on the broader community of both audiences and other speakers in ways that current theories are ill-equipped to explain. I'll argue that much of online abuse is best understood as a type of collective subordinating speech act, where this collective is an ad hoc group that constitutes itself through speech, and it is partly this group that gives online abuse the subordinating force that it has. Overall, my hope is to show that attention to online abuse is useful both for illuminating the harmfulness of that important phenomenon itself, and also for clarifying features it shares with in real life, or IRL, hate speech that regularly go underemphasized in the existing literature. It is not controversial to say that a lot of harmful speech now occurs online, yet much of the philosophical work in this area has focused on offline life. This immediately raises two questions. First, can current accounts of oppressive speech adequately capture digital hate? And second, how does the perceived anonymity of many online harassers contribute to the force of their speech? To answer these questions, I argue that the combination of anonymity and shared language offers online abusers a path to a type of group authority that lends more power to their speech than they might first appear to have. While most abusive messages online, tweets, emails, direct messages, and the like that harass, threaten, and otherwise potentially harm their targets, are uttered by individual users acting for myriad reasons, I claim that the cumulative effect of receiving dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of these messages impacts the force of these speech acts in a significant way, backing them up with a unique type of authority and making them unlike offline hateful speech. Thus, I argue that online abuse is best understood as a type of collective subordinating speech act. In other words, online abuse of speech is a form of subordinating speech where the speaker of one of these messages is better conceived as a collective, though often an ad hoc one. To make this argument, I explore the popular model that claims that speakers can gain subordinating authority through processes like licensing and accommodation. The basic idea is that while a hate speaker can lack the necessary authority to subordinate before they make their utterance, because of the silence of bystanders, the audience fails to block the speaker's speech act, imbuing it with subordinating force. This approach has proven quite fruitful at explaining the outsized harm a seemingly powerless individual can achieve through their speech. Yet, I argue that it fails to explain the dynamics of online abuse, and that this failure reveals a more widespread tension in the concept. I begin in section 1 by outlining some ways in which internet speech is different from non-internet speech. This will, in many ways, be familiar to most readers, but it is worth making it explicit as these features shape our speech acts in profound ways but too often fall from view. After this general overview of the distinctiveness of online speech, I then describe, in section 2, some of the key features of my narrower topic, online abuse. In section 3, I explain how these features pose a problem for existing accounts of subordinating speech, particularly around the notion of authority. This leads me to develop an alternate conception of the subordinating authority at work in online abuse. Section 4 is devoted to developing this idea, focusing on first, the role of anonymity, and second, the use of shared language in constructing and sustaining this distributed and collective speaker authority. Here, I include some considerations about how this conclusion could impact the types of mechanisms social media platforms use to mitigate the harms of abuse on their platforms. Throughout, I argue that much online abuse challenges existing accounts of subordinating speech. It, therefore, represents in some ways a distinct phenomenon. At the same time, though, I believe this analysis can also shed light on some IRL subordinating speech. That is, I aim to show how online speech makes explicit many features that it shares with offline hate speech, but that tend to be ignored or de-emphasized in existing accounts. Despite the internet offering bigots and abusers new tools and strategies, For the victims, the experience of being targeted by such abuse can be remarkably similar. The examination of online abuse, therefore, helps reveal key features of subordinating speech across mediums. I make these connections explicit in my conclusion. Section 1. Internet speech. It's different. To state the obvious, online speech is different from offline speech. Terms like IRL, meet space, and others make plain what we all know in a moment's reflection. What occurs online and through our screens is different and distinct from what happens outside of those parameters. This is not to claim, though, that Twitter isn't real life. Far from it. My position is that what we do online is just as real and significant as our offline actions, but that we must appreciate the differences that the medium presents. For starters, unlike standard in-person speech, online speech is mediated by an immense infrastructure of cables, wires, servers, satellites, modems, internet service providers, electricity grids, data networks, computers and smartphones, and so much more that is at the same time incredibly obvious, as well as somewhat hidden from view. This infrastructure plays a role in determining who is able to perform online speech, as well as how early users often set the tone for acceptable behavior long after a much larger and more diverse group of users comes online. The fact that we can trace a line from the early history of trolling to current tactics in online harassment suggests a lineage from the sociological history of the internet to some of the problems we now face. And beyond the physical infrastructure of the internet, along with its economic history, we must also acknowledge that the platforms that currently host the bulk of online speech, Meta platforms, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple, make decisions that shape the contours of online speech. Perhaps most significant is the invisible and opaque algorithmic amplification and moderation that each platform employs. However, more mundane aspects, like the default settings around public and private profiles, who can send DMs to whom, message length restrictions, image capabilities, limits on sharing, forwarding replies, and much more are all features that have concrete impacts on what speech acts are possible in online environments. At this point, it must be admitted, though, that the internet is a big place and that different platforms offer different affordances. So, with an admission that none of the following is universally true for online speech, let us consider some further distinguishing features of much of how we now communicate over the internet. First, a lot of online speech, as written text, is in an important way less embodied than offline speech, or at least differently embodied. Our texts, tweets, emails, and the like usually occur within a small screen that we interact with mainly via our thumbs and fingers. This fact is both banal and significant. It has the consequence that when reading the words of another, we can experience it as a voice within our head, perhaps in our own voice, rather than as speech directed at us from the actual lips of another agent. Talking with another becomes, in some cases, talking with oneself. Additionally, most online speech is asynchronous, at least to an extent. This sits along a spectrum, with some formats, such as email and message boards, on one end, and other nearly but not quite real-time formats on the other. But even supposedly instantaneous platforms, for example, WhatsApp, Zoom, these admit to delays, outages, and buffering that manage to interrupt what we might think of as the normal flow of a conversation. The effect is that entirely different norms take hold when we cannot rely on the immediate feedback of an interlocutor. Even when using supposedly live chat applications, simple things like how long it is appropriate to wait before following up are norm-governed practices impacted by features like read receipts and timestamps. Anonymity, or pseudonymity, is an often cited feature of online communication. This, too, is best conceived along a spectrum, and one with multiple axes. While at times we may be speaking anonymously to other participants on a forum, this does not imply that we are anonymous to the site's host. It comes in degrees, from the relatively rare total anonymity one might have in certain parts of the web, to the anonymity of a screen name that does not easily lead back to one's offline life. And I include here the kind of anonymity one finds in a crowd, even when they use their real name. There is also the ambiguous state of the audience that is typical of so much online speech. Social media posts are often characterized by a genuine uncertainty about to whom one can be said to be speaking. One's tweets, for example, might be read by only a handful of one's followers, or perhaps by thousands of strangers with whom this could be one's only interaction ever. For most users, it is simply unknown exactly to whom they are talking when they hit send. And, as many cases of sudden online infamy show, we can be drastically wrong about who our actual audience ends up being, like when a larger public gives uptake to utterances meant only for semi-private consumption. That this occurs demonstrates how our online speech acts are not in our control. As we speak online, our communicative goals can be seemingly outstripped by the medium, where the broader community's norms may play a greater role in determining what exactly we meant and what we did with our words than our own intentions. One reason this can occur is that platforms take some effort to hide from us the algorithmic architecture that renders this speech situation entirely unnatural. Facebook may ask you what's on your mind, and Twitter might goad you to tell it what's happening, but this is merely in support of their underlying goal to incentivize you to produce more free content for them. The fact is that our seemingly ephemeral expressions are cataloged in their servers where the data is mined to sell advertisements, and our willingness to share is fed by a rush of endorphins caused by carefully crafted notification systems and user interface designs. In a classic article on the topic, John Seller notes that similar features lead to what he calls the, quote, online disinhibition effect. People, he noted, acted differently online than offline. He was careful to note that there is both benign and toxic disinhibition, and more significantly, that this was not meant to suggest that one's online self was somehow more real. Similarly, I do not mean to imply that these features of online speech make it somehow more artificial, more constrained, or less genuine than offline speech. Adaptation to online, mediated, text-image-based environments has been swift and full of ingenuity far beyond what platform designers could predict. A whole language of emojis and GIFs sits at our fingertips. My point here has simply been to remind us of these differences as they point to a noteworthy architecture that scaffolds our communicative acts. Fundamental questions like who or what should count as a speaker, or how retweets, likes, tagging, and emojis should fit into an account of utterances, all need to be re-examined, as does my current question, how has the internet changed harmful speech? The philosophical literature on subordinating speech has seen steady growth for a few decades, and while the internet has been around almost as long, much of the philosophical work on hate speech, propaganda, and subordinating speech in general has focused on offline life. In-person hate speech, like what you might see in public spaces, propaganda as it is disseminated in print or on the radio, and more recently, microaggressions as they occur in settings like the workplace or college classroom, are the main examples. This has remained the case even as more and more of our lives have migrated online. But online speech raises many new issues for social philosophers of language. The overall context of online communication, the total speech situation, as Austin would call it, is radically different from that of offline communication. To begin to explore these differences, let us briefly consider the internet's impact on propaganda, including notable subcategories like fake news or mis- and disinformation. One initial thought might be that all the internet has done is make it easier to spread propaganda to more people more quickly. And that would be problem enough. However, the reach and speed of the internet is but one concern. Beyond these issues, further complications arise. Regina Rini argues that social media posts can be considered a bent form of testimony, whose features exacerbate pre-existing problems. That is, are unstable norms around sharing information online, for example, how a retweet does not equal endorsement, or does it, enable old tensions to flourish in new ways. For Rini, fake news is not limited to online communication, but there is, as she says, quote, a strong contingent relationship between fake news and social media, making the one the ripe for the other. As she says, quote, perhaps people are less inclined to subject ridiculous stories to scrutiny because we have unstable testimonial norms on social media. A friend posts a ridiculous story without comment, and maybe they don't really mean it, but then other friends like the story or comment with earnest revulsion or share it themselves. Each of these individual communicative acts involves some ambiguity in the speaker's testimonial intentions. When all appear summed together, this ambiguity seems to wash away. End of quote. Rini's analysis shows how fake news can spread organically, where little to no malicious intent is needed, because of the distinct features of online communication, specifically social media. Other theorists, such as Zeynep Tufekci and Michael Lynch, worry that the personalization algorithms used on Facebook, YouTube, and other platforms make a hard problem, what to believe in our saturated information environment, even harder. And as Tufekci adds, quote, social media's business model, financed by ads paid out based on number of page views, makes it not just possible, but even financially lucrative to spread misinformation, propaganda, or distorted partisan content that can go viral in algorithmically entrenched echo chambers, end of quote. The worry, therefore, is not simply that social media permits the rapid spread of propaganda, but that it has also incentivized new forms of propaganda to emerge, reach their targets, and further entrench themselves in communities. At the extreme, the crossover between online hate and real-life violence is hard to deny. After the New Zealand mosque shootings, New York Times writer Charlie Warzel wrote, quote, "It's becoming increasingly difficult to ignore how online hatred and message board screeds are bleeding into the physical world, and how social platforms can act as an accelerant for terrorist behavior. The internet, it seems, has imprinted itself on modern hate crimes, giving its most unstable residents a theater for unspeakable acts, and an amplification system for an ideology of white supremacy that only recently has been relegated to the shadows." End of quote. This pattern has repeated itself in other locales, most explicitly in Buffalo, New York, where a shooter once again posted their manifesto online and attempted to live stream their acts for an online platform. It is undeniable, therefore, that harmful speech enabled by emerging technology poses new sorts of problems of urgent concern. Violence, arguably caused by online propaganda and misinformation, has been reported in many countries, including the US, Myanmar, Germany, India, and Canada. The role of Facebook, YouTube, and other platforms in exacerbating regional conflict is a contested debate. It is noteworthy, however, that the bulk of this debate addresses online subordinating speech as it functions in its propagandistic mode, as outreach, or as a source of hateful ideas that later causes harm, rather than on cases where it is speech directly targeting particular individuals. This is apparent in the focus on online speech's ability to manipulate beliefs and otherwise poison the information environment. This sometimes leads to discussions of the potential harms of online hate, disinformation, or deepfakes that focus on abstract values like democracy or civility as its main victims. However, it ignores those who have already been victimized by online hate. In what follows, I examine online abuse as a topic worthy of serious philosophical investigation. I aim to bring out its structural elements, while also drawing attention to how it is experienced by those targeted. Section 2, Online Abuse. The previous section provided a broad overview of a few features that make online speech distinct from IRL speech, as well as some reasons to worry about novel types of harmful speech online. At the general level, I believe we need to understand the peculiar features of these speech acts, including the material, structural, and design affordances that enable them, in order to assess any threats they may pose and consider how we might mitigate their harms. To demonstrate this, the remainder of the paper will focus on the narrower topic of online abuse. Offline models of subordinating speech do not easily accommodate the online features of this type of harmful speech, so it calls for reconsideration. In this section, I will lay out some notable aspects of online abuse, and in the next, I will show how these pose a challenge for standard philosophical accounts on offer. To begin, we need a better idea of what online abuse includes. Media studies professor Emma Jane articulates the breadth of the problem well in her aptly titled paper, "You're an Ugly Whorish Slut, Understanding Ebile." Jane coins the term ebile to capture what she describes as the, quote, "extravagant invective, the sexualized threats of violence, and the recreational nastiness that have come to constitute a dominant tenor of internet discourse." Jane stresses how this ebile is found in nearly all corners of the internet and displays impressive flexibility in terms of functional use, but also that its effect varies depending on factors like who is targeted and what particular speech acts are being performed. That is, noting first how common this type of vitriolic speech is and how and when it combines with other factors can help to pinpoint when it rises to the level of online abuse. on its commonness and flexibility, Jane writes that, quote, hyperbolic vitriol, often involving rape and death threats, has become a lingua franca in many sectors of cyberspace. It is a commonsensical, even expected, way to, among other things, register disagreement and disapproval, test and mark the boundaries of online communities, compete and create, ward off boredom, prod for reaction, seek attention, and or simply gain enjoyment, end of quote. And yet, despite being put to so many uses in so many contexts, Jane notes that, quote, the rhetorical constructs of individual eval texts are strikingly similar in terms of their reliance on profanity, ad hominem invective, and hyperbolic imagery of graphic, often sexualized violence. She concludes that ebile is found in nearly all corners of the internet and is used to perform a wide variety of speech acts, but at the same time has a uniformity across these usages, with expressions of sexual violence being a prominent trope. Interestingly, Jane says that in many cases, quote, ebile appears to be a pleasurable, albeit competitive game, in which players joust to produce the most creative venom, break the largest number of taboos, and elicit the largest emotional response in targets. It is a sort of commonplace online derogatoriness, and for this reason she suggests that, quote, what looks like hate speech might be better classed as boredom speech or gaming speech. However, as Jane is quick to note, while this may reflect the intentions behind many of these utterances, this does not capture the range of effects the targets of ebile may experience, which can, in some cases, be very serious. She says that some of those, quote, who have been targeted by ebile generally report emotional responses ranging from feelings of irritation, anxiety, sadness, loneliness, vulnerability, and unsafeness, to feelings of distress, pain, shock, fear, terror, devastation, and violation, end of quote. This is particularly the case, moreover, when what the target receives is not a mere one-off message, but an abundance of vitriolic and violent utterances. Their email inbox, Twitter mentions, DMs, etc., become flooded with horrendous comments and threats from a large number of strangers. And here's where we can begin to narrow from the more general rhetorical patterns common to ebile down toward the phenomena of online abuse. What in some contexts may be a type of expected, consensual, though misogynistic, mutual banter, in other contexts can constitute a type of verbal attack. That these utterances share similar rhetorical styles, and that they are undeniably common in online communities, should not distract us from the fact that their power to harm varies relative to the type of actions they are used to perform. Below, I'll explain more fully how the utterances of online abuse function to harm their targets. Here, I simply aim to delineate the topic, noting that online abuse is partly characterized by its sheer scale and volume. This widespread circulation is what we refer to when we mean something has gone viral. While I maintain that a particularly determined individual can inflict online abuse through cyberstalking or cyberbullying, my focus will be on cases where the harassing language comes from multiple speakers. Moreover, there is also the plain fact that if one is a member of an oppressed group offline, then that identity affects how likely they are to suffer abuse online, and of course, what form that abuse will take. Research from the Women's Media Center Speech Project confirms that women are more likely to be victims of online abuse, and the content of that abuse is overtly misogynistic. Men and women of color often receive racist comments in response to mundane posts, especially if they are public figures. For targets, these messages often form a pattern, and that pattern maps onto and is a part of broader structures of oppression. It is these two features that raise these individual pieces of ebile from one-off oddities to become the harmful, indeed abusive, speech acts that they are. However, before explaining how these utterances harm in the way they do, and how that poses a challenge to philosophical accounts of harmful speech, I first want to address the issue of the motivations behind these utterances in more detail, as this helps clarify my approach. That is, as Jane and many others note, the functions and motives behind abusive rhetoric are more diffuse than might be expected. Even when directing messages towards outgroup members as part of what we might call an overall abusive campaign, individual posters of vile content may do so for wildly varying reasons. This leads some commentators to suggest that they are not really engaging in a type of hate speech, so it is best to just ignore the trolls. However, it is worth highlighting that many emotions besides hate motivate hate speech. As Jeremy Waldron puts it, quote, "Hatred is relevant not as the motivation of certain actions, but as the possible effect of certain forms of speech. That is, what this speech aims to, or is likely to incite." So, while it is true that the motives and superficial purposes of online abuse might vary, one-upping, building solidarity, etc., a more insidious function plausibly sits just below the surface: the intimidation of outsiders in order to exclude, and the reification of existing hierarchies of domination. And this function, I argue, is achieved partly through the group activity that online abuse becomes. It is by recognizing the red herring that is the individual speakers, or shitposters, underlying psychology, and in particular the irrelevance of their stated motives, that we are led to put the focus back on the act the speech performs, along with its expected effects. That is, its illocutionary and perlocutionary dimensions, to use the speech act theory terms of Austin. In the next section, I turn to the philosophical literature on subordinating speech, in part to demonstrate why it is not up to the task of assimilating online abusive speech into its offline apparatus, before describing how online abusive speech attains its subordinating force. Section 3. The authority problem for online abuse. If subordinating someone through speech is a type of power that only some speakers have, then a natural question to ask is who holds this power, and how do they acquire it? This is the authority problem for subordinating speech, and the question of what authority conditions enable different types of subordinating speech acts is a topic that has received sustained analysis. Many compelling answers to this authority problem have been developed, including the claim that, in fact, speakers do not require any special authority to subordinate with their words, or, if they do, all that is needed is a type of informal authority within a given domain. Other models show how speakers can come to gain the authority they lacked prior to speaking through processes like licensing and accommodation. This last approach has proven quite powerful, and it will be my focus as I leave the others largely aside. The basic idea of accommodation is that while a speaker can lack the necessary authority to subordinate before they make their utterance, their speech act can nonetheless contain a presupposition of authority. If their audience fails to block the speaker's speech act by remaining silent, then this presupposition of authority is successfully added to the speech situation, understood as the score, following a Lewisian framework, and or the common ground, following a Stalnackerian framework. The thought, explained by Ray Langton, is that speech acts, quote, including directives generally, and hate speech specifically, can acquire authority by an everyday piece of social magic. Authority gets presupposed, and hearers let it go through, following a rule of accommodation. But online speech poses problems for accounts of licensing and accommodation. In particular, the role of silence in online spaces is not straightforwardly analogous to offline spaces. For this reason, Alexander Brown argues that, quote, it can be harder to infer assent, licensing, or complicity from silence in the face of hate speech when that hate speech occurs online as opposed to offline. The upshot of his analysis is that the standard story of how speech, or speakers, may be licensed to achieve subordinating authority is importantly incomplete for online speech. If bystander silence is required for licensing, but online bystander silence is notably different from offline silence, license authority may be harder or impossible to come by for online hate speakers. Moreover, according to the standard picture of accommodating authority, blocking, where an audience member rejects or challenges the speaker's utterance, including its presupposition, should be sufficient to cancel authority from being accommodated. As Langton describes it, quote, a hearer who blocks what is presupposed also blocks the speech act to which the presupposition contributes. That is why blocking a presupposition can make the speech act fail. It is worth emphasizing that Langton here is referring primarily to the illocutionary success of a speech act, not its perlocutionary effects, though it can affect this too, and that this is because blocking prevents, or rather undoes, by her account, the acquisition of authority. Quote, a successful blocker, she says, changes a past utterance from the unactualized way it would have been to the way it actually is. If a speaker's presupposed authority is blocked by here, that blocking changes the past. But in cases of online abuse, this does not seem to be what happens, or so I argue. Consider how, in cases of online abuse, a target might receive hundreds of messages, including some that are supportive, and do the job of challenging the speech of harassers, right alongside comments that encourage suicide or worse. Here, there is no single, linear conversation to map the score or common ground onto. I believe this goes some way to explaining why counter-speech standardly fails to render these speech acts non-subordinating. While it can help, it does not do the job of blocking or canceling a move in a language game, as Langton hopes. Why is this the case? I argue it's because the conversational dynamics of online speech are very unlike IRL conversations, where, paradigmatically, there are two parties who engage in a back and forth. Even when we add more participants, the image is still of a single, continuous thread where each new contribution builds upon and is constrained by what preceded it. Blocking makes sense in this context, as it is itself a contribution that future moves must acknowledge. But if you have ever looked at the replies under someone's viral tweet, you will know that this is not what is going on. Some comments get traction, while others are ignored. Multiple, overlapping conversations all occur at once, playing out in a manner whose progression is hard to track. And when you add reply or quote functionality, the ability to call back to a specific moment in the exchange is enhanced. This all leads to a sort of branching of multiple conversations, if we even want to call them that, whose IRL parallel is hard to find and that do not share a single, easily traceable common ground. Another answer to why blocking moves typically fail online emerges from considering the speech acts being performed here in more detail. As Jane notes about Ebile, quote, "The point is rarely about winning an argument via the deployment of coherent reasoning, so much as a means by which discursive volume can be increased. Ebile is utilized, in other words, to outshout everyone else." End of quote. Seen in this way, it becomes clear why more speech, blocking speech, often will not work. Recognizing that its point is not to add new content to the conversational score, content that might be contested, but instead to inundate its target with a barrage of hurtful words and imagery, shows the limits of this standard approach when the assailants number in the dozens, hundreds, or even thousands. Seeing this speech for what it is thus explains the question about blocking online, that is, why counter-speech cannot effectively do the blocking work it is supposed to do. To be clear, this is not to say that counter-speech is pointless or serves no purpose. It's simply to show its limits and how those limits expose conceptual problems within the accommodation framework. That is, this also demonstrates how the accommodation model relies on an overly rational, psychological picture of how content gets added to the common ground. Challenging messages that, in theory, ought to undo the initial speech acts often fail to do so in practice, and the harm and subordination remain. We see this in how targets of abuse can still experience legitimate harms despite the presence of blocking utterances from others, as well as how harassers often do not acknowledge that any counter-speech has even occurred and instead carry on as if it had not. So, considering the apparent inability of the accommodation account to explain the force of abusive speech performed online, I believe we need to look elsewhere. Specifically, what is needed is an alternative account that can explain how seemingly powerless and often anonymous speakers can attain subordinating authority, even in the face of counter-speech. Rather than the somewhat passive model of accommodation, I believe a much more active process is in play. Online abuses, I will argue, are best understood as cases of collective subordinating speech acts, as they are backed up by a collective authority attained by a chorus of speakers. In the following section, I explain how the sort of anonymity of the crowd made possible in online spaces, along with the coalescence around shared language, enables a mass of speakers to attain a type of authority that impacts the force of their speech acts. Section 4, Online Abuse and the Construction of Collective Authority. When considering the type of online abuse I am directing us toward, it can seem obvious, trivial even, that much of the power that lies behind these utterances emerges from sheer numbers. This is part of the story, to be sure. The impact of a large number of speakers directing their hostility at a single target is not something that can be ignored. And online abuse harms in the way it does, in part because of how awful it can be to find oneself in an unwanted spotlight, particularly when this means one is bombarded by racist, sexist, and/or transphobic commentary. However, there are additional features beyond mere numbers that come into play and give online abusive speech the particular force it has. That is, there is more to the authority conditions that enable online abuse than simply scale. Below, I describe two features that each contribute to the authority that underlies abusive speech online, and in doing so, explain the subordinating force that it has. Section 4.1, Anonymity and the Force of Veiled Threats. As we have already seen, threats of physical and sexual violence are not rare online. Indeed, one of the common tropes of e-bile highlighted above is the ubiquity of violent misogyny. As Jane writes, quote, e-bile targeting women commonly includes charges of unintelligence, hysteria, and ugliness. These are then combined with threats and or fantasies of violent sex acts, which are often framed as correctives. Constructions along the lines of what you need is a good, insert graphic sexual act, to put you right, appear of such astounding regularity they constitute an e-bile meme. Female targets are dismissed as both unacceptably unattractive man-haters and hypersexual sluts who are inviting sexual attention or sexual attacks. End of quote. And while direct threats do occur, more common is violent aggression expressed in the form of hostile wishful thinking, such as, I hope you get raped with a chainsaw. While this indirect phrasing allows abusers to avoid legal trouble and skirt terms of service, it does not make these statements any less threatening to their targets. It is often, I claim, an escalation, as it seems to imply a coordinated group effort with a division of labor. That is, veiled threats of this sort are only properly understood when we consider them in their full context, where they tend to imply a larger network of harassers. First, if the threat comes from an anonymous or unknown account, a non-follower for instance, that might suggest that it was directed there by others, as the coordination of abusive campaigns is more common than many realize. As Sarah Zhang reports, quote, the examination of sustained harassment campaigns shows that they are often coordinated out of another online space. In some subcultures, these are known as forum raids and are often banned in even the most permissive spaces because of their toxic nature. In the case of the harassment of Zoe Quinn, Quinn documented extensive coordination from IRC chat rooms replete with participation from her ex-boyfriend, end of quote. Even if there is no explicit coordination, there is often an implicit type that works just as well. One common pattern in online harassment is for an account with a large number of followers to quote tweet, a type of retweet where the retweeter can add further commentary, another user mock them and subtly suggest that their own followers pile on. The dynamics of social media, which reward engagement, can often lead to an escalation in harassment as users encourage each other in their shared goal of belittling the person singled out. As legal scholar Danielle Citron puts it, quote, online harassment can quickly become a team sport, with posters trying to outdo each other. Posters compete to be the most offensive, the most abusive. Second, and a bit more subtly, the way that these utterances are given uptake reveals something important about how speakers accrue authority. As Lynn Terrell argues, quote, our speech acts also undertake a meta-level expressive commitment about the very saying of what is said. Expressive commitments are commitments to the viability and value of particular ways of talking, end of quote. These expressive commitments can shift the boundaries of what counts as acceptable behavior in a discourse community. And in the case of online abuse, given that harassing speech in this medium often receives likes from other users, these commitments to the value of this discourse takes tangible form. This helps shift the boundaries of permissibility. Alexander Brown gestures towards this idea when he says that, quote, the process of licensing hate speakers online could require more in the way of positive engagement with the hateful content, such as clicking the heart icon or adding a supportive comment via the reply function, end of quote. I agree, and I aim to make this explicit. As I am putting it, in online contexts, we can often see the shifts in the normative terrain resulting from speech acts backed up by subordinating authority by noting the numeric value in the likes and retweets harassment receive. So, what might at first glance seem like a one-off message from a single individual can, in fact, reveal a message from a group of like-minded people. It is in this sense that it is a mistake to view the speech acts typical of online abuse through an individualistic lens. As Citron says, quote, when cyber mobs attack victims, individuals each contribute little to the attacks. The totality of their actions inflicts devastating harm, but the abuse cannot be pinned on a particular person." End of quote. This poses a problem for criminal law, Citron's focus, but in general, taking this perspective is not too difficult. It simply amounts to listening to those who have experienced this harm. As Jean says, quote, "targets of harassment, particularly members of marginalized groups, may view a single comment differently than an outsider might because they recognize it as part of a larger pattern." End of quote. For those targeted by such speech, then, what is noteworthy is that online abuse can be read as a glimpse into the in-group speech of others, where marching orders are being given, are well-received, and might then be carried out by one of the many anonymous figures on the other end of the internet. This takes a very real toll on its targets. As Lindy West says of her own experience with online harassment, questions like, "Am I safe? Is that guy staring at me? Is he a troll?" easily flood your mind in public spaces. So, while anonymity poses challenges for the description of online abuse, namely by foreclosing some standard explanations for the authoritative force of subordinating speech, it in fact provides a powerful tool for those who wish to inflict harm on their targets. It is the combination of anonymity and apparent group solidarity, likes instead of condemnation, that is a dangerous mix for the targets of abuse, and I claim an important source of the authority these speech acts rely on to subordinate their targets. This is evident in Quinn's description of her own experience with online abuse. Quote, "I read many of the threats in my ex's voice, but this was somehow more insidious. He wasn't just continuing his abuse, he was crowdsourcing it." This vivid account is supported by media researcher Eden Litt's suggestion that, quote, "without being able to know the actual audience, social media users create and attend to an imagined audience for their everyday interactions. That is to say, when we cannot directly perceive our audience, we create it in our minds. This calls back to one of the defining features of online communication I described earlier, and here we see how it impacts the force of online abuse." With this in mind, Catherine Norlock notes that advising someone to ignore the trolls is beyond pointless. Quote, "the advice to ignore the social community as it lives in one's head is more than ineffective. It's missing the force." I believe this is exactly correct, that the force of online abuse, which is determined partly by the authority that sustains it, is dependent on the unique features of online communication. By seeing how anonymous avatars can become a monolith in one's mind, we can recognize a conception of subordinating speaker authority that, in fact, requires something like anonymity. It is in leveraging the target's own cognitive resources, namely their capacity for imaginal relationships, which are necessary given text-based communication, that large-scale online abuse campaigns become more than the sum of their parts. Beyond affecting the force of individual messages, anonymity creates the semblance of cohesion where there might not be any, uniting different speakers who might not have anything in common aside from their hostile speech directed at the same individual. Moreover, it is through speech that they become united, at least in the mind of the target. It is for this reason that I refer to these as collective subordinating speech acts, whose subordinating authority, its capacity to harm in the distinctive way that it does, is constituted by the active participation of an ad hoc community of speakers. Through repetition and endorsement, signaling support and solidarity, individual speech acts acquire authoritative standing in relation to a target, enabling them to harm. Each new utterance adds to the strength of the overall practice. Like accommodation, then, audience uptake secures authority for speech that, absent that uptake, would have a different pragmatic force. But as I have emphasized, in these cases, the practices that do the heavy lifting here are active, not passive. In all these cases, speech plays an active role in solidifying the collective authority that strengthens their words, turning it into the genuinely subordinating speech that it is. This is done in part through the construction of in-groups and out-groups. Herbert and Kukla point out that the recognition of insider status is something that comes into being through social practices that, in fact, constitute that status. They write that, quote, "being recognized as an insider by insiders is not just the recognition of a separate fact. Rather, this recognition plays a constitutive role in having that insider status. Part of being an insider is being recognized as one. Crucially, the relevant sort of recognition is not mere passive, conscious acknowledgement, but the kind of recognition that is built into practice." End of quote. In online abuse, this takes the form of harassers cheering on other harassers through likes, retweets, and one-upping in one another, along with other practices like coordinating on targets and sharing information. So far, I have argued that in cases of online abuse, anonymity, or at least the anonymity one finds in the crowd, can contribute to the active construction of a group identity that may be wielded to inflict great harm. But anonymity is only part of the explanation I want to offer. Shared insider language is the other. I turn to this next. Section 4.2, Shared Language and Solidarity. To start, it is useful to note that the affordances of social media make it clear how a user's speech act is always tied to their ever-shifting, socially constituted position, even when it is anonymous. Whether via a profile picture, short bio, hashtag, or emoji, social media brings new means of signaling identity. I want to emphasize, however, that this just amplifies what has always been the case offline. Mary Louise Pratt articulates this thought well when she writes, quote, "Once you set aside the notion of speech acts as normally anchored in a unified, essential subject, it becomes apparent that people always speak from and in a socially constituted position, a position that is, moreover, constantly shifting, and defined in a speech situation by the intersection of many different forces. On this view, speaking for oneself, from the heart, names only one position among many from which a person might speak in the course of her everyday life." End of quote. On social media, these implicit features of offline life are made fully explicit, often purposely so. Including a rose emoji or hashtag MAGA, for example, can instantly situate a speaker as part of a wider community and communicate their broader allegiances. These aspects of online speech allow individuals to actively construct and manage the version of themselves they present. This allows for a lot of the variety, freedom, and play, including the inconsistencies that Pratt describes, for example, concealing or emphasizing distinct parts of oneself for different platforms. What is relevant for my purposes is how, on social media, this type of signaling often occurs by parroting the speech acts of another. Speaking for oneself in this context often means speaking with the voice of another. While this is not an uncommon feature of speech, it is heightened and made explicit online, most obviously so through the use of hashtags, which allow one to visibly connect their own utterance to those of usually many others. This feature of social media has proven powerful, as large social movements can galvanize around a hashtag that, in essence, consists in joining with the voices of others. This can bring about both good avenues for effective solidarity and bad ones, as practices like the co-opting and appropriation of the words and voices of the more marginalized are all too common. For example, the phrase and hashtag Black Lives Matter has been taken up, twisted, and put to use for all sorts of ends, including by opposing forces. So, while I am talking about a more general phenomenon, here I want to focus on how this can contribute to the group authority at issue in online abuse. Namely, hashtags and related rhetorical constructions help unify the voices of many into an ad hoc collective. As I will describe it, hashtags are explicit ventriloquisms and are a vivid example of language's role in constituting a group identity. That is, as Quinn puts it, how, quote, "the same techniques that people have used to organize important grassroots movements like Black Lives Matter can be used by people trying to destroy someone," end of quote. In the course of building his account of slurs, the linguist Jeffrey Nunberg describes ventriloquisms, quote, "In a particular context, a speaker pointedly disregards the lexical convention of the group whose norms prescribe the default way of referring to A and refers to A instead by the distinct convention of another group that is known to have distinct and heterodox attitudes about A, so as to signal his affiliation with the group and its point of view," end of quote. That is, when a speaker uses a ventriloquism, they are disregarding the standard term that convention dictates and are instead mimicking the voice of another. In doing so, they signal their allegiance to a specific community, at least in that moment. Nunberg uses the example of a university dean using ain't in place of isn't to implicate that the knowledge being communicated was more folksy than academic. While Nunberg's main goal is to argue that slurs are cases of ventriloquisms, I aim mainly to get at an interesting feature of language, and I believe this account helps us get there. As he summarizes it, quote, "In a nutshell, racists don't use slurs because they are derogative. Slurs are derogative because they're the words that racists use," end of quote. Crucially, it is not just shared attitudes that are implicated, but shared group memberships. Quote, "As Langton Hughes tells it, the force of the N-word goes beyond anything the speaker believes or feels about blacks. It also evokes the things such people have done to blacks. With the speaker pointedly affiliating himself with the perpetrators, the word can turn a bigot from a hapless, inconsequential I into an intimidating, menacing we, end of quote. Without committing to this account of slurs, I do want to suggest that this analysis clarifies the pragmatic force of online abuse. Namely, the conception of ventriloquisms on offer demonstrates the potential of constructing a collective identity through shared language and tropes, as well as the ability for such a collective identity to undergird harmful speech. As I see it, hashtags and other shared rhetorical constructions function as explicit ventriloquisms, and in doing so serve to strengthen shared group identity for harassers. Hashtags are the most visible in part because they are literally visible, and their pragmatic function is to tie one utterance to many others. At their most extreme, they generate utterances with a first-person plural speaker, resulting in speech acts spoken by a collective we. They perform the function, in other words, of what Hughes, as told by Numberg, says slurs were capable of, and as a result can bring a similar subordinating authority to bear on targets. René Jorgensen-Bollinger develops a similar pragmatic account of slurs that can add to this story. While not a perfect parallel, Bollinger's contrastive choice account of slurs can add to the idea of ventriloquisms by explaining how marked expressions can carry important signals about their speakers for their audience. As Bollinger puts it, when we use slurs, we communicate information about ourselves and our attitudes towards the targets. This information is signaled, moreover, through a speaker's decision to choose a particular term over a non-marked alternative. As she explains, quote, "For signals based in contrastive choice, the relevant behavior is the free selection of a marked expression, and performance signals that the speaker endorses a cluster of attitudes associated with the term, or more precisely, a high probability that the speaker shares some or all of the attitudes in this cluster," end of quote. Using a hashtag, it is worth pointing out, involves a choice. It is literally marked in blue, generally, and in some situations, it communicates the choice of affiliation or association with other users. But I do want to suggest that this thought applies beyond hashtags as well, which, as I've said above, were simply the most visible version of this phenomenon. Some phrases, I claim, play a similar role as hashtags, and so function as ventriloquisms, without being so explicit. Most often this occurs when a hashtag phrase gains so much prominence that it enters the lexicon as marked in this particular way. Some examples might include Black Lives Matter, Me Too, MAGA, Gamergate, and even some longer phrases like "it's about ethics and journalism," which was a common trope in Gamergate. Or consider the use of the term SJW, particularly as it occurs online. This is, in most cases, used pejoratively, referring commonly to individuals who promote socially progressive views like feminism and anti-racism. Importantly, this term is used almost exclusively by those who oppose these goals. And using this term, then, whether prefixed by a hashtag or not, speakers pragmatically convey information about their own group membership to their audience. Again, as Bollinger helpfully explains, quote, "The information content of signals based in contrastive choice is linked to how marked the term is. Is alpha is a term that is used almost exclusively by speakers who embrace phi, and this fact is well known, then a contrastive preference for alpha is a high information signal, raising the probability of the speakers endorsing phi to nearly one. The more well-known the association between alpha and phi is, the higher the information content of the signal, and thus the more strongly the contrastive choice signals the speaker's endorsement of phi," end of quote. Since SJW is used mainly by its detractors, and since this is well-known, using it carries a high probability signal that the speaker endorses these views too. The act of signaling this information performs an important function for both insiders and outsiders. In short, what terms like this do when repeated so much as to be marked in this way is to express and solidify group membership. This is a dynamic process performed primarily through speech acts, and it is through this process, moreover, that the targets of online abuse come to recognize that they are being addressed not by a single speaker, but by a mob. This interpretation makes sense, moreover, since it is often exactly what is occurring. And as Zhang reports, it is this interpretation that makes sense of the, quote, "really bizarre behavior of all the low-level mobbers who have little to no real investment in going after the target and would not manifest any obsession with that particular target without the orchestrator to set them off. Here, they resemble the zombie nodes of spam botnets, right down to the tactics they have been observed to be deployed, Rote lines and messages are sometimes made available through Pastebin, a text-sharing website. And low-level mobbers are encouraged to find people to message and then copy-paste that message. End of quote. So here again, we see how in online abuse, the implicit is often made fully explicit. Speakers are literally copying and pasting their utterances from one another, and in doing so, adding strength to the subordinating force of each speech act. Shared language, along with the technological features of online communication, make this possible. More importantly, this shows vividly why an individualist approach to online abuse is inept for describing the force of these speech acts. It is only when we see these speakers as part of a collective, and a collective, moreover, that is constructed in part through the active use of shared speech acts, that we capture the pragmatic impact of these speech acts. They are, as I put it, backed up by a distinctively collective subordinating authority, and so are collective subordinating speech acts. Seeing online abuse as a sort of group activity encourages us not only to reject a lingering individualist lens, but also, I claim, is necessary for devising solutions to the harm they present. Reporters Max Fisher and Amanda Taub put this succinctly when they write, quote, "It is becoming increasingly common for groups of people whipped into a rage by influential people on social media to single out targets for mass campaigns of online harassment and threats. The main problem seems to be that social media companies' guidelines tend to focus on content in isolation. Because the accounts that instigate the hatred and rage don't necessarily participate in the mass harassment directly, often their followers are the ones who send the death threats or do the doxing. This problem is a poor fit for that approach." End of quote. As this shows, tackling this problem properly requires addressing the collective from which the speech draws its power, whether it is an organic ad hoc group or a pre-existing community with a clear, if informal, hierarchy. Seeing this bigger picture is helpful in explaining the damage it can do to a community and paints the way forward towards effective solutions. Social media companies can track this behavior, like they do all our behavior, and rather than basing their moderation decisions on individual pieces of content examined in isolation, they could focus on these patterns: swarming, copy-pasting, mass movements and attention across platforms, and other group-based practices rather than the content. Section 5, Conclusion. In this paper, I have examined what I take to be some key features of online abuse. I have emphasized the role of anonymity in cultivating the appearance of coordination and a division of labor in online abuse, even if in fact there is none, and shown how shared language plays an important role here as well. That is, I argued that anonymity plays a key role in building a type of collective authority for online abusive speech acts and, moreover, that the construction and endorsement of this group identity through shared rhetorical constructs like hashtags further adds to the target sense that they are being addressed by a collective rather than individuals. I argued that this combination of anonymity and apparent group solidarity, shared phrases and hashtags, likes and retweets, is a dangerous mix for targets of abuse and an important source of the authority these speech acts rely on to subordinate. It is in this way, I argued, that online abuse becomes more than the sum of its parts. These and other features build collective authority for seemingly isolated speech acts and, as I will now suggest in closing, reveal aspects of IRL subordinating speech that are often overlooked. In other words, I believe that greater attention to features similar to those I have highlighted in the online case can help bring out underemphasized aspects of offline hate speech: racist graffiti spray painted on college campuses, slurs yelled from passing cars, white nationalist flyers displayed in public, all invoke a sort of anonymity and group activity in a similar way to create an overall environment of exclusion. Across mediums, the force of any individual subordinating speech act draws on many other instances of similar utterances made by similar speakers, and this should be made more explicit in our accounts of its pragmatic functions. This follows from the more general observation that accounting for the realities of subordinating speech, both online and IRL, demonstrates that speaker authority is dynamic and emergent, and often depends on the wider community in more ways than simple accommodation suggests. Passive bystanders play an important role, to be sure, but greater attention must be paid to those who actively back up the subordinating speech of others. As I argue, this sort of contribution leads us away from an individualistic understanding of oppression, as is necessary. Online abuse makes this vivid, but I claim this is a feature shared by IRL forms of subordinating speech, and one that must be kept in mind. The end. Thank you. I've been Mike Barnes. from the Australian National University.